live. In the same way that The Daily Show with Jon Stewart was live, it's The Mike Novak Show, your exclusive ticket for a one-way trip into the dim recesses of my lizard brain, a place from which even Rod Serling would have run screaming, except that I can't imagine Rod Serling running anywhere. Everybody sing!
Good planets are hard to find. Temperate zones and tropic climes. And true currents and thriving seas. Wind blowing through breathing trees. Strong ozone and safe sunshine. Well, good planets are hard to find. Good planets are in demand.
And thank you so much for joining me on the Mike Novak Show. Whether you're listening via the Green Divas Global Digital Network at gdgdradio.com, or iTunes, or Spreaker, or Stitcher, or SoundCloud, or the GLN Radio Network, or even on my little old website, mikenowak.net, MikeNowak.net. When you do live radio, you often don't know you've got a keeper, and I'm talking about a really, really good show, until after the fact. You go back and listen, you go, oh, that was really good. But when you put together a podcast, you know ahead of time. This is one of those podcasts. When I finished my interview with Dr. Harry Klee of the University of Florida, who's on today's show, I thought, whoa, that was a good one. So I'm very excited to tell you to sit back for about 50 minutes and listen to the story of what might be the perfect tomato and why you might not ever be able to purchase it in a supermarket. On the other hand, you might be able to get a hold of it. That's all part of the story. And as always, I invite you to go to this week's show on mikenowak.net to find more information and to support my sponsors. You can do that by going to the Mike Novak Show Referral Network. Just go to my website and look for Mike's Referral Network on the homepage. It's up in the upper left-hand corner. And I love to hear from my listeners, so drop me a line. Write to mike@mikenowak.net, MikeNowak.net, if you wonder why I pronounce it like a V and not as a W. I'm Polish. It's pretty simple. Tell me what you like about the show and even what you don't like. I can take it. Okay, let's get to the funny, sad, sordid, and sometimes baffling tale of the tomato that should be on everybody's kitchen table, but isn't. That's up next.
Trying to weather the housing market? Consider replacing your windows and siding. Remodeling Magazine says they're some of the nation's most popular projects today.
Trust DR Services Unlimited, 847-998-1687 for all your remodeling and energy needs. Rated A-plus by the Better Business Bureau and recommended on Angie's List. DR is a proud member of NARI. DR provides exceptional quality at a fair price. Contact DR at 847-998-1687 or at RestoreTheNorthShore.com.
Every time I open up an issue of Chicagoland Gardening Magazine, I know I'm going to learn something. And if you've ever read my column on the inside back page of said magazine, you'd understand what a compliment that is, because I don't learn anything easily. You might pick up some knowledge in one of the excellent feature articles or one of the regular departments like Ask the Garden Pros, or the regional reports, or What to Do in the Garden. Or you might even be inspired by one of the luscious photos. Not only that, but Chicagoland Gardening Magazine is just one of 21 different publications of state-by-state gardening. Wherever you live in the Midwest or the South, State-by-State Gardening has a magazine for you. They feature articles by some of the leading gardening experts in each state, including famous authors, nursery owners, state extension agents, master gardeners, and even me. Subscribe today by going to statebystategardening.com or call 888-265-3600. 888-265-3600.
There ain't
ain't nothing in the world that I like better than bacon and lettuce and homegrown tomatoes. Up in the morning, out in the garden, get you ripe.
A little while ago, one of my staff posted an article on my Facebook page, the show Facebook page, and Rosemary is the person who did that, and she puts a lot of stuff up there. But this particular article caught my attention, as it should. Anybody who's ever listened to this show or has ever grown anything, the title of it, and it was from Slate, the title was, "This is the perfect tomato, but supermarkets refuse to sell it." A guy named Mark Schatzker wrote that story, and I read it with interest, and I was amazed and at the same time appalled. And I realized that I had to get the guy, and it's true, according to the article, there is this tomato that tastes great, it ships well, it grows easily, all the things you want in a tomato, and yet you're probably not going to see it in the supermarket, and I needed to know why. So I got on the internet, and it wasn't hard to track down Dr. Harry Klee, who's a professor at the University of Florida in Gainesville. And Dr. Klee, it's great to have you on the show.
You're welcome.
You are in Gainesville, and you've been doing your research there. In fact, go to my website, mikenovak.net, and find Harry's Tasty Tomato page. And did that get you noticed at all in what you were doing? I can't imagine that anybody who's ever grown a tomato could see that story and not respond strongly to it. You must have gotten some correspondence out of that at the very least.
Oh, you have no idea. a few months ago, we put up a link on my webpage. I got a lot of requests, well, a lot, relatively few now, of requests from people for seeds because they were excited about what we were doing. And, you know, at some point I said, I have to figure out how to get these to people while we wait for seed companies to license them. And so we started offering them online for a donation to the research program.
Yeah, I saw that.
So we started that in March, and I think from March until, through the end of May, we probably had maybe 50 or so people who donated, and we sent them the seeds. When Mark's article appeared, we got, within the 3 days after that article appeared online, we had 600 requests.
Wow.
We've been flooded by people who really want to try our tomatoes, and that's great, you know. I knew people were excited about tomatoes, and everybody is disappointed in commercial tomato flavor, but we were pretty overwhelmed. We're in the last, now we're up to 1,400 individuals who have requested seeds from us.
And how many of those seed packets have you gotten out?
Virtually all of them. We try and keep up as much as we can. We're trying very hard, but within a few days of people donating, we're getting them out. So we've sent out almost 1,400.
My goodness. Well, you're going to have to send out one more because I intend to grow this. In fact, I was just thinking about it when I saw that you were sending out the seeds, and it didn't even occur to me that you might have been overwhelmed by requests at any time. I thought, well, I'm going to write. It's too bad it's August. On the other hand, I have a portable greenhouse, one of those things you set up, and it's like 7 feet tall by 8 feet wide and or long and like 6 feet wide. It's very portable, and you can set it up on a slab of concrete outside. And we have, and I thought, you know what? I might be able to start growing it now and actually get a crop by the time that everything freezes and shuts down in Chicago.
Yeah. You know, I feel badly for people in places like Illinois and Minnesota who are asking for the seeds now. But, you know, we've had a lot of response from people in Florida, California, mm-hmm. Arizona, who actually can still get them in this year. So we tell everybody, you can try it if you want, but save them for next spring and start them in February. You'll be all ready to go.
Yeah, and that was the thing I thought about. I can't wait a year to try this. I need to see how good this tomato is. And of course, you call it the garden gem. Mm-hmm. And we need to tell this story because folks are probably wondering with my tease at the top of this segment, why in the world it is not in supermarkets, and why in the world are tomato growers not interested in this? And before we get to that, I actually want to go back a little bit because according to that story, you at one time worked for Monsanto.
Yes, that's true.
You know, that's the evil empire, of course.
Well, that's what some people say. That's not what farmers say.
No, and not people who get paychecks, I imagine, either. But they wanted you to create a tomato that, at least from Mark's story, was genetically engineered. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's true. You know, at the time that I was at Monsanto, it very much preceded all of the furor over GMOs. And honestly, everybody there thought we were doing great things, and I still think they were doing great things, and we were. But, you know, at that point, there were everybody. I remember when I actually came to the University of Florida now 2 decades ago, our research dean said, oh, well, the costs of GMOs are just going to keep going down as technology advances and more of them are introduced. In fact, it's been exactly the opposite. It costs tens of millions of dollars to get approval now for a new GMO product. It's pretty much shut out academics like me out of the business. We can't even consider that approach now. But at the time, we had some technology that we knew could extend the shelf life of a tomato dramatically. And, you know, and even to this day, most of the commercial tomatoes, particularly in Florida, are picked when they're still green. And that's largely because the grower has to ship it to places like Chicago, and they have to have a very long shelf life. And we had this naive idea that, well, if we could slow down the ripening process, you could pick them when they were more ripe and had more of an ability to develop good flavor. And then you could ship them the long distances and get a better tasting tomato. And in theory, it was fine. But in practice, we ran up against the tremendous costs of registering GMOs. And Monsanto decided that it was not an economically wise choice. And that was just about the time that I left to come to Florida.
Now, at the time when you were working for Monsanto, were you an educator already, or were you a scientist in a public scientist? What was your status?
I was a scientist there. We developed a lot of the. I helped to develop a lot of the herbicide-resistant crops that are grown, well, basically across the whole world right now.
Now you're going to take me off on a tangent here. because and very briefly, because we will get back to the tomato, folks. Don't worry. We're going to get back to the tomato. What about, you know, the idea was if we can create these crops that are resistant to certain herbicides, and then we can apply the herbicides, we will use less of them. But mm-hmm. that doesn't seem to have been the case in that, as you know, we've created super weeds that are resistant to some of these herbicides. And so some farmers have to go back to the old arsenal and bring in stuff that they might have used before. Some reports say they're using more pesticides. What's your response to that?
Well, I think you need to separate out a couple of facts. First of all, some of the insect-resistant crops, they're using vastly fewer chemicals. And some of those chemicals were nasty. I mean, you don't want to walk through fields that have been sprayed with some of these insecticides. And so overall for GMOs, I would say that the use of chemicals is down significantly overall. If you look at the herbicide-resistant crops, I think what you're seeing is you're correct that there are some weeds that are developing resistance now. The idea was never that you'd eliminate the use of pesticides or herbicides in particular. It was, number one, that Roundup is probably the safest chemical in use in agriculture today. Its toxicity is virtually zero. And some of the chemicals that it replaced, now you'll never get the chemical companies to say this because they're in the business of making chemicals, but many of the chemicals that Roundup resistant crops replaced were fairly toxic, relatively toxic chemicals, things that accumulate in the groundwater, things like atrazine. So there was a shift to much safer chemicals, and that's why the farmers really like the technology. They didn't have to use some of these obnoxious things. They're much, much safer to use. And the other advantage of the technology is that the farmer can go out once and spray the field, and it's revolutionized the use of no-till agriculture, for example. The old way, yeah, maybe they used a little less chemical, but they were going out and they were plowing up their fields to dig up the weeds and kill them. Now the farmer doesn't have to do that. He's not using as much gasoline to run his crops, his tractor across the field. He's also not digging it up and causing topsoil loss. If you've ever seen the Mississippi, there's a reason that it's brown.
Yeah.
And
I just talked about that on a previous program about the runoff into the Mississippi, and part of it's the soil and the silt that runs down, and the nutrients, phosphorus and nitrogen.
That's right. So herbicide-resistant crops are not, they're not the end of the world. They're not they're not the perfect panacea, but they're a definite step in the right direction. They reduce the use of more toxic chemicals. They reduce greatly the work that the farmer has to put into his or her field, and there is somewhat less chemical applied. But they're not perfect, and now you are getting resistant crops that are coming up. And so what the farmer is now going to have to do is what they've done for centuries, and that is to rotate. You can't just throw Roundup resistant corn and Roundup resistant soybeans out in your field and rotate between those two and expect everything to be wonderful. You're going to have to go out and use different chemicals to kill the resistant weeds. That's not a new phenomenon. I mean, the Greenpeace people make it sound like it's a horrible thing. Well, this has been happening for decades, long before GMO crops. You use chemicals. It's the same as with antibiotic resistance. Pediatricians, mother comes in and screams about her kid has a runny nose. The pediatrician prescribes an antibiotic, knowing full well that it probably isn't going to do anything, and now we have antibiotic-resistant bacteria everywhere. It's the same phenomenon, but there are ways to deal with it. The bottom line to me is farmers are businessmen, and farmers, in my experience, are ecologists. They care about the environment as much as anybody, and farmers have adopted these crops wholeheartedly. They love these crops, and I don't think that they would use them if they thought they were dangerous or harmful to the environment.
Send your cards and emails to Harry J. Klee. PhD at the University of Florida in Gainesville, and then we'll have that information in a second. Like I said, that's a rabbit hole. That's a different conversation altogether. And I actually do like talking to scientists about it, because the people who listen to my show are the ones that are likely to shout at me, no, you can't ever use Roundup ever. Well, I happen to know that if you never used Roundup, there would be no ecological restoration. It would not exist. Okay.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
Because I have friends in the business who say, that's in my toolbox. I have to use that. And then they say to me, I hope I only use it once. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, after I've created a new prairie or a new woodland, it takes care of itself. But like I said, this is a rabbit hole. We won't go down it at the moment. When we come back, Dr. Klee is going to tell us about the, and I'm using air quotes here, the perfect tomato, but it sounds pretty interesting. So stick around for that.
Captain's log, stardate 42326.1. The Enterprise is under attack by an apparently hostile life form. Mr. Worf, status report.
Inexplicable, Captain. They appear to be perambulating vegetables. We are being stalked by stalks of asparagus.
That is incorrect, Mr. Worf. Asparagus officinalis, or killer asparagus, was the subject of a very popular 21st century tome by the brilliant author Mike Novak.
Mike Novak. I'm familiar with his work.
Mike Novak was one of the smartest, funniest people in the horticultural world of the 21st century.
Sound red alert. Shields up. Tell me more, Mr. Data.
He has been variously compared to Mark Twain, Dave Barry, and Edgar Allan Poe.
Edgar Allan Poe, author of my favorite children's stories.
Captain, I am attempting to access a copy of the masterpiece. It seems to be available online at aroundtheblockpress.com.
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 Yes, Mr. Watt.
Yes, Captain. Aroundtheblockpress.com.
How many times can I say it?
It takes more than nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium to optimize plant vigor. In fact, if you've heard my show recently, you know that you can put too much of that stuff on your lawn. Fortunately, Milorganite contains all 13 essential plant nutrients, including secondary nutrients like calcium and micronutrients like iron and zinc. Milorganite's slow-release formula provides its nutrients over an 8 to 10-week period for even growth and better root development. It's goof-proof. Milorganite for better results naturally. Visit Milorganite.com to find a garden center near you.
Go out and pick me up this homegrown tomatoes, homegrown tomatoes. What'll I be without homegrown tomatoes? Only two things that money can't buy, and that's true love and homegrown tomatoes.
I'm on the line with Dr. Harry Klee, PhD, who is at the University of Florida in Gainesville, and the reason he's on the program is we're all in search of the perfect tomato. And it's quite possible that he has come up with that fruit. And I guess okay, what's your... now see, here's another way we can
another
get this...
Another hole.
exactly. Fruit or vegetable?
It is most definitely a fruit, despite the U.S. Supreme Court ruling 100 years ago that it was a vegetable.
interesting. Yeah, well, I have to agree with you. By definition, it is indeed a fruit. And so you mentioned earlier that you had worked for Monsanto and were working on trying to make a better tomato. And then you left the company and you went to the University of Florida. But I guess you were still obsessed by this, weren't you?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Moving to Florida gave me a completely different way of approaching the problem. Let's face it, when you work for a company has to make money or it goes out of business. Companies can only look at a horizon that goes out so far, or the stockholders get very upset. Moving to an academic setting basically changed everything for me. Allowed me to take the long view of flavor. What we were doing earlier was an indirect method. It was like saying, okay, let's make these mediocre tomatoes taste a little bit better. Now we can take the long view and say, well, as long as I can get grant money from the government or somebody, then I can really take a systematic approach to understanding what is flavor, what's wrong with flavor, and how do we fix it.
And that's kind of what you did. I was looking at your website, and by the way, if you're looking for it, I can give them the URL, if they were to look at it in a search engine, what are the words that will make it come up?
Oh, gee.
And it's at the top. I'll tell you what, type this in. Welcome to Harry's Tasty Tomato Page. I'll bet that'll do it.
That'll work.
And the idea being was twofold or multifold. Let me put it that way. You wanted a tomato, obviously, that tastes good. Mm. But you also wanted a tomato, since you're trying to get this commercially sold, you want a tomato that is going to produce prolifically, and you want a tomato that can ship. What other considerations are there?
Well, for us, the number one is flavor by far. I mean, it has to have flavor. And, the real challenge has been to make it, I can't tell you, there have been some people who write to me and say, I don't even know why you're doing this. I can grow my heirloom tomatoes and get something that tastes great. And I write back usually to these people and say, yeah, you can do that for 2 months of the year, and you get like maybe three fruit on a plant, and they have a shelf life of about 2 days. And I say, that's fine if you're Alice Waters and you want to, eat what's in season and only when it's in season, but that's not what most people want.
Mm-hmm.
Most people want to be able to eat a tomato when they want to eat one. And that's been a real sea change, I think, in the last 50 years or so.
Although, let me stop you there, Harry, because there, as you say, with the Alice Waters reference, there are restaurants, there are slow food people who have changed and gone back to that idea that just eat what's in season. And you're going to be fine. Now, we do live in the 21st century, and we have a worldwide connection. We get, as you mentioned on the website, kiwis from New Zealand and tomatoes from, I'm in Illinois, tomatoes from the West Coast or from Florida. Mm-hmm. So they are available, and you're not going to stop people from wanting tomatoes in December.
No. And I think that's putting it in the wrong context. I think the people who phrase it that way are fighting a battle that doesn't need to be fought. I think that the concept of some of these high-end restaurants is, yes, they want to serve food that tastes great, and they've decided that there's an either-or here. We can only eat it if it's local and in season. And I'm trying to fight that battle, because that's not the way that most Americans eat. Most Americans want to eat what they want to eat when they want to eat it. And so, the problem with the current system is that there has been a deterioration in flavor. So while I'm sympathetic to the people in the Alice Waters movement, I understand exactly why they say that, but this is not an either-or. The thing is, we can apply modern breeding techniques, and that's not GMOs, that's just modern classical breeding, to make things that taste much better. And so the ultimate object, and we're not there yet, is, can I give you in Chicago a tomato that tastes really good for more than 2 months of the year? So that's the objective of all of this. We want to have people eat better. And this is really the message that I hope that we can hammer home, that people are making very poor food decisions in their lives because they can't get access to the really good stuff. So yeah, some guy can get his heirloom tomato in Whole Foods and pay $6 a pound for it, but that doesn't help the person on food stamps who says, well, I'd like to eat a tomato, but they're just not that good. And I'd like to be able to get it cheaper, and I'd like to eat it year-round. That's really what we're going for.
Yeah, and ultimately, the ultimate extension of that argument, I guess, and believe me, I see both sides of this, but the ultimate extension of that argument would be, if you live in Chicago, you never get to eat a banana or an orange because it's got to travel. You're going to have to ship it.
Yeah, that's right.
And so you don't get the potassium, and you don't get the vitamin C.
Right.
And everybody knows that's absurd, that we need our citrus vegetables, fruits, and there I go. So getting back to heirlooms, as you say in your website, there is no legal definition of an heirloom cultivar. And what you say here is heirlooms are really cultivars that have been superseded by something better. I'm not sure what that means, Harry.
Well, you know, heirlooms basically are varieties that were once commercial, maybe 50, maybe 100 years ago, and commercial farmers found something that was better, easier to grow, and make more money off of them. And so they've been pushed aside. And so, yeah, they have great flavor, but most of them are really difficult to grow. They have virtually no resistance to diseases, and the yields are really low. And what we're trying to do is to say, you know, let's go back 100 years in flavor, but we don't necessarily have to go back 100 years in terms of the overall plant health. You know, so we're trying to find the best of both worlds, something that will grow well, and so the home gardener can grow it in their backyard and get lots of really great tasting fruit, and ultimately, hopefully, we can develop stuff that tastes just as good as those heirlooms, but commercial growers will say, oh, well, you know, maybe I can make some money selling this stuff.
So you went back to a number of these heirloom varieties, as you say, some that
yep.
grew well and probably some that didn't grow well but had reputations
yep.
as having fabulous flavor. And what did you try to find out from these heirloom varieties?
Well, so we've probably grown well over 200 different heirloom varieties, some of them going, the oldest ones I know of go back to about 1870. We've grown them all out. We originally did this so we could understand what is flavor, what is good flavor. And so anybody who has grown heirlooms know these things are all over the place in terms of taste. What we tried to do was in theory very simple, in practice very hard, and that was we have a big consumer panel here on campus with like 100 people in it, and we gave them lots and lots of different heirlooms and said, how much do you like it? And so they rated all of these different heirlooms for how flavorful they were. And what we did is we were using that information to then grind up the tomatoes and measure what's in them, the sugars, the acid, the volatile chemicals that give it its flavor, and say, well, what really defines what a good tomato is? And we were doing that so that we could basically set the goalposts for where we wanted to get our tomatoes.
Can I stop you for a second? I think a lot of people and I could be one of them, or at least I was until I read all this information that you've got posted here. I thought it all boiled down to sugars. You know, the tomato with the highest sugar content was going to be the most flavorful, but that's not exactly the case, is it?
No, it's not. And the way that I usually explain it to people is that flavor is so much more than taste. People confuse the word taste with flavor. So taste is what happens in your mouth. It's sweet, sour, salty, bitter. But think about the last time you had a cold and you couldn't breathe very well. You could taste perfectly well. You can taste, when you have a cold, you can respond to sweet and sour just fine. But you can't smell. Smell is really what gives people flavor. So, you know, think about wines, think about anything, any food that you eat. You know, we basically only really have five basic flavors that we can taste on our tongue. But you know, there's a whole lot more than five different things that you eat in a day that taste all different. That all comes from smell. And so you have to have sugar. People really do like sweet tomatoes. And there's no doubt that people like cherry tomatoes or the grape tomatoes because they have more sugar in them than the large tomatoes. But you can do one simple experiment. Take a tomato and stick it in the refrigerator for 2 days and then pull it out and taste it relative to one that you've left on the kitchen counter. If you taste those two tomatoes, they're going to taste vastly different. They're going to have exactly the same sugar and exactly the same acids, but the refrigerated one is going to be much lower in its volatiles, the things that you smell. And that is a really good hands-on experiment to show you just how important smell is to flavor. So we focus a lot on all of those other chemicals besides the sugars and the acids.
Okay. I didn't think I was going to do this, but it doesn't surprise me that I am, and which is I'm going to hold you over for yet one more segment here, and we're going to make the whole show about this because we still haven't even gotten to the point where the supermarkets looked at your tomato and surprised you with their response. And so just so folks know, I am talking to Dr. Harry Klee out of the University of Florida, and it was his quest and still is to create the perfect tomato. And as I said before, you can find all this information. I've got links and actually how to get some seeds from his department there and grow the garden gem. And you've got, how many others do you have there that you're giving out?
We have two that we've released and two more that we're close to releasing. So basically we have four.
All right, I want all four. All right, that's
and just, we can do that.
Okay, great. That's what I'm looking for. That is the correct answer. And we'll be back with Dr. Harry Klee in just a second.
Hi, I'm Peggy, and I've got great news about Natural Awakening Chicago. We're now available throughout the city and suburbs, from Lake County to the Indiana state line. If you own a green business or offer healthy living or wellness products and services, you should be working with our marketing team to get your message out to our targeted audience. Join us, won't you? We're online at nachicagonorth.com or call us today at 847-858-3697. Natural Awakenings. Feel good, live simply, laugh more.
Could an app be the answer to a better garden? Absolutely. It's the new free app, Homegrown with Bonnie Plants. Note, track, and photograph your garden's progress. Personalize your weather and reminders. Get variety info, grow guides, hands-free dictation, and more. The Homegrown with Bonnie Plants app, the sharpest tool in your garden. Download it free on the App Store.
Now if I was to change this life I lead, well, I'd be Johnny Tomato Seed. Cause I know what this country needs. It's homegrown tomatoes in every yard you see. When I die, don't bury me.
For those of you who have been listening to the show today, this is the payoff. This is where we find out what happens when a professor develops a tomato that has a wonderful flavor, can be grown readily, ships easily, and yet is turned down by the powers that be. And for those of you who are used to being turned down by the powers that be, and I'm raising my own hand here, I understand what that's like. We're talking to Dr. Harry Klee from the University of Florida. And when we left off, Harry, we were talking about flavor and what you had discovered about flavor. I need to get to one point here that just stuns me, because you employed your colleague, Linda Bartoszuk. Is that how you pronounce it?
Yeah.
She's a psychophysicist. And when you were doing questionnaires about the taste of tomatoes, you threw in questions that really didn't have anything to do with tomatoes. Why did you do that? And tell me what some of those questions might have been.
Well, we anchor our scales, the top and the bottom of the scale, with something that has nothing to do with flavor. And that's for a fairly simple reason. The easiest way to explain it is the way Linda talks about it. She developed this scale for pain. Your definition of what really hurts is very different from a woman who's undergone childbirth or a guy who's had kidney stones. Doctors ask you when you go into the hospital, how much does it hurt on a scale of 1 to 5? And it's just the wrong question to answer, because it entirely is dependent on your context of what you've experienced in your life. What I think hurts a lot is not necessarily what somebody else thinks hurts a lot. What I think something tastes great may be completely different from what you think tastes great. So we try and come up with sort of anchors to position the scaling that are independent of flavor, to understand how much you really like flavor and what you think. So Linda's developed some very sophisticated methods that let us ask 100 people how much they like a tomato and put them on a scale that actually means something.
That is just fascinating, and it shows how scientifically you approached this. All right, so you develop, after a number of trials, how many, you know, tomatoes did you actually develop that you thought were contenders?
We screened probably about 200 informally and about 100 formally with our consumer panels, and got an idea of what were the really good ones, what were not so good. You know, just because it's an heirloom doesn't mean it tastes good.
Oh, yeah, and I need to add here, because, you know, earlier we talked about you having worked for Monsanto on GMOs. These were not GMO tomatoes, were they?
No, absolutely not.
So you weren't injecting salmon genes into the tomato to get a good taste?
No, there's no way that we want to go down that road. It's just too controversial. We want to make a tomato that everybody wants to eat, and nobody is going to say, oh, no, I can't touch that. There's no GMO involved.
That's good. So you tried out these tomatoes, and what did you find?
We found that some of them taste really good, and some of them don't. So we took the ones that taste really good, and we said, well, can we improve the way they grow? And so what we did basically is we made hybrids. We took a modern, high-yielding, highly disease-resistant variety, and we made made crosses, just taking the pollen from one and putting it on the flower of another, just the way the bee does it. And we made hybrids between the greatest tasting ones and the greatest yielding ones. And a lot of them didn't give us exactly what we wanted. There's a lot of trial and error here, as in any plant breeding program. But a few of them really clicked. A few of them gave us great flavor, equal to the heirloom parent, but really good yield and really good plant performance. So those few, so out of the dozens of different crosses we tried, you know, you asked earlier, we're down to 4 that we really like. And so it was a trial and error process, but we got a few varieties that give us the best of both worlds, high yields and great flavor.
You know, there's another disqualification from, and not me, some people are going to say, well, I don't grow anything but heirloom varieties, so I'm not going to grow this tomato because, as you say, it's a hybrid. What are wonderful about hybrids is something that I failed to mention earlier in the conversation, disease resistance.
That's right.
You've incorporated that into your tomatoes, I take it.
Yeah. I mean, you know, people want to save their seeds. That's great. I save seeds of heirloom tomatoes all the time, and that's all fine and good. But the reality is you're paying a few pennies per seed per plant goes into the seed, to the cost of the plant for buying new seed. It makes good sense to buy new seed every year, even if you're growing heirlooms, because you know it's disease-free, doesn't have viruses, it's been processed properly to be clean and and sanitary. You know, the cost of the seed is trivial. It's fine if you want to save heirloom seeds, and that's great. And as I say, we do it ourselves, but we also know how to clean up the seed and get rid of any contaminating disease organisms from the fields. But hybrids, you know, people have been growing, you know, Pioneer Hybrid, one of the largest seed companies in the world, introduced hybrid corn back in the 1920s, and all of the commercial corn, all of it is hybrid now. Mm-hmm. There's nothing wrong or evil about hybrids.
Well, as we mentioned earlier, though, there's a difference between a hybrid and a GMO product, and again, yeah. We're not going to go down that road.
Totally different.
Let us just say that your tomatoes are hybrids. Mm-hmm. And so, you go to the supermarkets, you go to the growers, you say, I've done it. I've found a tomato, tastes great, disease resistant, grows well, ships well, here you go. What happened?
Well, the growers have one big question, and that is, how does it yield relative to the commercial variety, which tastes like cardboard, but the commercial variety that I'm growing right now? And I can go back and say, I can give you 90% of the yield of your modern tasteless variety, and it tastes great. And the growers say, I'm not interested. They say, come back when you've got 100% of the yield of the modern varieties, because, and here's the kicker, I'm not paid for producing things that taste good. I am paid to produce 25-pound boxes full of tomatoes. And until I have a way to capture value for growing flavor, I have no financial game in this. So that's the bottom line, is that the grower is not paid to produce something that tastes great. If they were, they would jump all over this, but they're not. And so until we pay the farmer to produce something that really tastes great, they're not going to do it unless it's got 100% of the yield of the modern commercial varieties. We're not quite there.
Wow.
And so they're going to say, flavor is irrelevant to me financially. Now, there are a few exceptions, and we've been contacted. We've sent seeds now to a lot of, there are some smaller growers. One guy in Chicago actually contacted us and says he wants to get some of our seeds because he is focused on a niche market of producing things that taste really good. So people who produce for farmers markets, restaurants, they can capture the value for a great tasting tomato. But the commercial guys in Florida, Mexico, California, it's all about how many pounds of product they can put in a box.
By the way, maybe off air, you can give me the name of the Chicago guy. It's possible.
I don't think he'd mind.
I don't think so either. It's possible. I know him because I know a lot of growers, and I don't know if you know if he's in Chicago or near Chicago, but who knows? You know, yeah, I visit farmers markets too. But it seems to me that if you're a person who in the summer grows heirlooms because you love the taste, and then the season's over and you had your 2 months of tomatoes, and it really does seem like a short time the way you describe it, mm-hmm. And you know that this tomato is out there and you'd love to have a tomato off season, and you're not philosophically opposed to that concept, why wouldn't you buy this? So I was talking to my partner Kathleen today, and I said, well, here's the way I envision this working. You go to a supermarket and there's the tomatoes, and one end it says tomatoes, and then there's that little boutique on the side that says Garden Gem, and mm-hmm. of course the Garden Gems are always sold out because people go there first and then they're stuck with the others. Why wouldn't that kind of concept work?
It will work, and so that's so what we're attempting to do. And I have to say, the guy who wrote the Slate article, Mark Schatzker, has been one of our biggest fans, and he's been great. I'm going to have to start making him like a partner. his mission, and he's a food writer, and his mission in life is to get people things that taste as good as possible. And so he's been working, he lives in Toronto, and he's been working, for example, to with some of the local supermarkets there to try and get them. He hooked up a grower to grow them locally and provide them to the supermarket. And again, it was not a huge chain. It was one of these sort of local markets that caters to certain customers. They loved the tomato. They said, we could sell these if you can get them to us at a reasonable price. So this is our goal, is to educate the consumer and get them to demand. Until the consumer says, I'm not going to buy your crap, and I'm willing to pay for something that's not crap, you know, the supermarkets will just keep providing the stuff that they do. So, you know, the consumer has to stand up and say, I'm willing to pay a little more for something that really tastes good if you'll provide it to me.
And you're right. Mark Schatzker wrote an excellent article in Slate about this. I was immediately drawn in to this conversation and to this idea. I think, though, that if folks knew the tomato was out there, right now they don't realize that they might have a choice, and that if they do the right thing, perhaps that choice. And maybe it, Mark, in his article, uses the idea of craft beer,
yes.
Which used to be called microbreweries, and now we just call it craft beer.
Oh yeah,
and he said, and I don't know if this is your quote or his, that you want the Garden Gem to be the Sam Adams of tomatoes.
Yeah, he came up with that quote, but I'm totally behind it. You know, when I lived in St. Louis 20 years ago, you could get Bud Light, Bush Light, and Michelob. And I started brewing my own beer. and it's a very, very good analogy. You're seeing it now with some of the places like Whole Foods and some of the high-end supermarkets. People are starting to become more educated with their palate, and this is a great turn of events. 20 years ago, everybody complained about tomatoes, but they kept on buying them. Now you've got some alternatives. Now what we have to do is we have to make those alternatives, much like Starbucks, you know, ubiquitous.
Yeah.
You know, people also like to bash Starbucks. I spent a lot of time in Seattle and say, well, Starbucks was my local coffee shop. And what Starbucks did is in many ways what we're trying to do, I think, and that is to raise the bar, to educate people and say, look, this is what's possible. And while it may not be perfect, it's a hell of a lot better than what was out there.
I think one of the things that you've bumped into, and it's the same, it's a human trait. We like the way things work now, if they're working, and change is bad.
This is why the Florida growers are not especially interested. It's like, well, we've been doing this since 1910, and this is the way we grow our tomatoes, and we don't understand what you're trying to do. you know, we had actually a grower try our Garden Gem tomato, and he said, well, it's too small, and it's something that it'll cost a lot to pick all those tomatoes. And I said, yeah, but, you know, they're going to taste better. And
will the consumer be able to demand the Garden Gem or a similar tomato? Or do we have to wait for the folks who, you know, and I don't know, this chicken and egg thing, is it the growers so much, or is it the supermarkets, or is it the middlemen involved in this? Who controls this?
Well, I mean, the nice thing about all the publicity from this article is we have been contacted by several growers, you know, not huge growers that can supply nationwide, but growers who are in specific regions who can try our tomatoes, and if they like them, if they think that they can make money at them, they'll put them in the supermarkets in specific regions. And I hope that it'll grow, much as Mark said about the craft beers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I think I think that the grower needs to know they can make money. I mean, let's face it, they're conservative people. You know, they have to stay in business, and farming is expensive. And so we have to convince them that the market exists, that there are people out there who really want this and will pay money for it.
And something else you mentioned earlier, or that Mark mentioned earlier in his article, and you just talked about, was the tomatoes are slightly smaller. A lot of people don't buy the big ones. I'm one of those people because I don't know what to do with them. You know, if you got a hamburger, you can slice it, and then you put that one slice. Of course, then you got 3/4 of a tomato left that you're trying to figure out what to do with. B, they pick cherry tomatoes. So
exactly.
It can't be the size.
So yeah, it's that intermediate size. Again, they look at it and say, "Well, it's not a cherry and it's not a beefsteak. What is it? I don't know what to do with it." But you're absolutely correct, and we've done a lot of consumer research. You know, it goes well beyond tomato. Our entire program is focused on what does the consumer want and like. And all of our research, we've done these studies. We know that consumers don't want a large tomato, exactly as you just said it. You make a slice and you put it on a sandwich, and then you go, well, what do I do with the rest of it? Consumers don't mind a medium-sized tomato, especially if it tastes great.
Yeah.
The ironic thing is that the growers get paid the most money for the largest tomatoes. And it's exactly the opposite of what the consumer actually wants.
Yeah, yeah, because you can buy a cherry tomato. One of the reasons I'll buy a cherry tomato in the winter is I know it's going to have some flavor. Mm-hmm. It may not be like I pick it off of in the sun in my own backyard in the summer, but I know at least it will have some sweetness. It will have some flavor.
That's right. That's right. And that's what I tell people in the winter. To be honest, you know what I do in the winter time? I buy sun-dried tomatoes and put them in my salads.
You know, that's very smart. That's very smart indeed. Well, Dr. Harry J. Klee from the University of Florida, this has been so much fun and so interesting. And I wish you the best on your research, and I'm hoping that you can get those really good-tasting tomatoes out to the public as quickly as possible. But I'm going to start by writing to you and getting some of those seeds myself. Yeah, it was great talking to you. Thanks so much, and you and I will chat soon.
You're welcome.
That's today's show. Hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. Go green or go home. You can find more information about the Mike Novak Show at mikenovak.net. That's MikeNowak.net for links, photos, and commentary.